From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR Sports Show, Only a Game. Whether you think that sports cliches are oldies but goodies, only fair to middling, or simply too bad for words, one thing's for certain, they're here to stay. Ahead on Only a Game, our twisted look at the universe of sports cliches, which includes a program for girls who throw like, well, like baseball players, a program that enables college sports teams to be team players with chronically ill children, and a very British sport that transforms the phrase, the ball's in your court, to the bowls on your lawn. Also coming up, Zippy Chippy, the retired wonder horse with 100 races and zero wins to his credit, gives new meaning to the phrase, you are what your record says you are.
He is quite famous. He has quite a lot of fans. Actually, every day he's getting new fans when they hear his story. People just think he's adorable.
Stay tuned. This is a special edition of Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Both teams came to play, somebody blurted, and then somebody else barked. We'll take them one game at a time. The fever was upon us in the corner of WBUR, given over to Only a Game. The cliches were bouncing off the walls, threatening to careen into the news department, a development that would have loosed listener emails dripping vitriol on the reporters and producers had the cliches ever aired. You win some, you lose some, said the intern. You can't judge a book by its cover, shouted some well-meaning clown who didn't understand that we were limiting ourselves to cliches set in sports. That set up the remedy for which we and everybody else can thank Ring Lardner. Shut up, I explained, in quotes. And then it was all downhill, or uphill, or something, to the show. Hall of Fame NFL coach Bill Parcells once famously said, you are what your record says you are. Parcells has dabbled in horse racing, so I wonder if inspiration for that realist quote-turned-cliché was provided by a horse that got more attention than he deserved, or at least more attention than he earned.
There's just something about that name, Zippy Chippy.
That's Bill Flynn, then a reporter for member station WXXI in Rochester, New York. He was on the scene in 1999 for Zippy Chippy's record-setting 86th consecutive race without a win.
He jumped right out. He was amongst the contenders, and through most of the race, he was there. He fell from the leaders in the last quarter mile of the race and finished about 13 and a quarter lengths back.
That same week, Only a Game sent a reporter out to meet Zippy, which wasn't an easy feat. Once the reluctant racehorse started running, it was actually difficult to get him to stop.
Oh, Zippy. Oh.
That's Zippy's trainer, Felix Monserrati.
And long he want to keep running, I'm going to run him. Even if he runs slow. I think he feels sad when he don't do something. That's why I keep training him.
A year later, Zippy was still running, and he was still slow. In 2000, during my weekly Zippy Chippy update with Only a Game analyst Charlie Pierce, I noted that the little gelding, who couldn't and never has and no doubt never will, ran his record losing streak to 87 when he finished second at a county fair right here in Massachusetts. Zippy ended his racing career with a record of 100 races and zero wins. In the summer of 2013, on the occasion of Only a Game's 20th anniversary, I went in search of Zippy Chippy to offer our apologies and perhaps a carrot. I found him in Greenfield, New York. Zippy Chippy runs no more, unless he wants to, say when he's at the far end of the corral and somebody shows up at the gate with something good to eat. That somebody is likely to be Joanne Pepper, Zippy Chippy's landlord and his most enthusiastic fan.
He is quite famous. He has quite a lot of fans. And actually, every day he's getting new fans when they hear his story. People just think he's adorable.
Zippy Chippy's story is, of course, that he ran in 100 races without winning one. Well, actually, according to Joanne Pepper, he ran in 97, tops.
He stopped leaving the starting gate when it opened at Finger Lakes three times in a row, and then you get kicked off the grounds.
So he was kind of the Ferdinand the Bull of thoroughbred horse racing. He would rather smell the flowers than participate in the competition.
I think so, yes. Or he just enjoyed, you know, being gracious and letting everybody else go ahead.
Zippy Chippy did manage to finish second eight times. He got a few thirds. His career winnings totaled $30,000. It's a record that makes one wonder why his owner kept bringing Zippy Chippy to the track. Joanne Pepper thinks part of the reason was that Zippy came cheap.
He was owned primarily by Felix Monserrati, who got Zippy in a trade for a pickup truck and raced him throughout his entire career.
And how many times did he find himself thinking, I should have held on to the pickup truck?
Oh, I don't know. 100, maybe? But I think most trainers would think, I don't think this horse really wants to race. And Felix thought Zippy enjoyed losing, so he kept letting him lose.
Zippy Chippy's current home is at a farm called Old Friends at Cabin Creek, established 10 years ago in Greenfield, New York, a quick run from the track in Saratoga Springs. Well, quick for any horse but Zippy. Anyway, Old Friends, which is supported by donations, a few grants, and fundraisers, some featuring Zippy, is home to 14 retired racehorses, though capacity is supposed to be 12. According to Joanne Pepper, Zippy Chippy is among those okay with sharing space with a pal.
His name is Red Down South, and he's 12. The minute they got together, they became best friends, and they have not been separated since. So he's lucky. That's really the truest horse relationship that I've ever seen. Zippy loves Red and respects him, and Red looks out for Zippy. It's beautiful.
It was raining on the August day when I visited Old Friends at Cabin Creek. The farm was beautiful anyway. It was chilly, too, but the horses didn't seem to mind. I found myself wondering out loud in the presence of Joanne Pepper whether Zippy Chippy, reluctant racehorse, laughing stock, butt of the jokes of 1,000 railbirds, had at last found the perfect home.
He has. I think Zippy's as happy as he can be. He looks great. He's 22 years old. He's healthy. He gets a lot of carrots, so he's well-fed, and I think he's happy.
If you want to see Zippy Chippy or any of his more accomplished neighbors at Old Friends, summer visiting hours are noon to 3 on Saturday.
And be on the radio?
Call ahead and bring carrots. I always give 110% effort is one oft-heard sports cliche. Putting aside the mathematical difficulty inherent in that statement, what it really means is that an athlete is giving more than anybody thought possible. In November of 2013, reporter Christine Laskowski met with powerlifter John Stoklosa, a 32-year-old born with Down syndrome who was placing high in regular powerlifting meets and could bench press 400 pounds. She paid a visit to John's home state of Delaware to uncover the secret of his success.
It's 9 a.m. when John Stoklosa arrives at the gym. He's already put in a 2-hour shift at the local supermarket. If he's tired, he doesn't show it. John is ready to train.
I'm going to focus bench press, deadlift, and quad. I'm going to listen to coach and Brandon Goffin. Walk off, focus.
Today's a max effort bench day, which means that John starts with an empty bar. His trainer, Brandon McGovern, increases the weight in 40-pound increments, bringing John to his limit of 400 pounds. So far, so good. Here's Brandon.
We're always going to try to hit maximum loads because John's ultimate goal is to move as much weight as possible one time.
Things are going really well for John. He's competing not against other special needs athletes, but in regular competitions and consistently coming in around third place. The youngest of three boys, John's dad, Hank Stoklosa, told me how John discovered powerlifting.
Started lifting with his brothers down in the basement. They were doing burnouts, curl burnouts, you know, just until your arms fall off. And John realized that he had a lot of strength. And then what happened was, I think he realized that he got a lot of attention for powerlifting.
But with a special needs child, where the instinct to coddle and protect is often stronger, the Stoklosas resolved to let John try all kinds of things, just like their other boys.
We always put him in positions where he could fail. And somebody asked me, well, why do you do that? And I said, so he can grow.
One of those times was when John competed on the Newark High School wrestling team. His record? 1-61. But Hank says, by putting John out there, even though he lost a lot of matches, John won a lot of something else. Respect.
When he went into school, no one tipped his tray. If he wanted to sit at this table, nobody gave him any trouble because he had like 15 brothers out there. And that made all the difference in high school.
When John was born, his parents tell me they never imagined he would be where he is today. Here's John's mom, Liz.
When they're born with a disability, and I don't think it necessarily has to be Down syndrome, it's funny how your mind goes from this tiny little infant in your hands, and I remember feeling like this. We went all the way to when he was old, like my God, what's going to happen with him? Who's going to take care of him? Is he ever going to be able to work? We were way, way in the future. We weren't even thinking about taking care of this baby.
Down syndrome is a genetic condition and occurs when someone is born with an extra full or partial copy of chromosome 21. The additional genetic material affects development, both cognitive and physical, resulting in easily recognizable traits like smaller stature and an upward slant to the eyes. But others are less apparent, like low muscle tone, cardiovascular issues, and something known as atlantoaxial instability. Wanting to know more about the physical limitations Down's athletes face, I paid a visit to Midtown Manhattan, to the office of this woman.
I'm Evelyn Ernie, and I'm the owner and clinical director of Pivotal Physical Therapy.
Evelyn's a physical therapist with a son who has Down syndrome, and while Evelyn has never met or worked with John, she knows how much harder certain movements or training practices can be simply because their bodies are different. For instance, core and abdominal strength are much tougher for those to build with Down syndrome.
So oftentimes then when you see children with Down syndrome trying to get into a vertical position, they have difficulties with front and back balancing and coordinating. The muscles of the extremities, like, you know, the biceps, the triceps, and then the quads and the hamstrings and the glutes, they are perfectly ready to be trained and strengthened. What's going to be hard, as I said, is to stabilize it to the torso.
And because those with Down syndrome have looser ligaments, atlantoaxial instability is laxity in the place where you need it the most, where the spinal column meets the base of the skull.
If that ligament doesn't hold, you can get compression of the spinal cord. If fully severed, you die. What's working in his favor is the relatively shorter limbs, so you can create a lot more power with the muscle you have with shorter limbs.
Squat. Up. Let's walk him in. Nice squat, John. Well done. Good.
Back in Delaware, as practice is winding down, the loving, forward-thinking powerlifter gives me some insights into what his future holds.
I'm the happiest. I'm pro wrestler.
That's right. John's already performed some in the local semi-pro wrestling circuit. And in case you're wondering, John's got a wrestling name. He came up with it himself.
Mr. Hardcore.
Mr. Hardcore?
Yes.
But I notice John lights up the most when he talks about his high school sweetheart, Katie, who also has Down syndrome. John then lets me in on another major life decision.
Me and Katie are going to marry. Me and my Katie.
Is this the new announcement?
Yes, it is.
I love her. It's mine.
For Only a Game, I'm Christine Laskowski.
Throw like a girl is as much an insult as it is a cliche. It used to be heard quite a bit in sandlots, but not so much lately thanks to baseball players and teachers like the ones I met in the summer of 2011.
This cage.
Baseball camp is about baseball, of course, which means every camper gets a turn in the batting cage, and they all get advice.
And keep your weight back because curveballs are going to be coming at you instead of away.
The instructor on Tuesday afternoon at a baseball camp in western Massachusetts is Michaela Seiler, a former Little League All-Star who pitches for a high school team in Florida. The hitter with whom she's working is a 13-year-old named Jackie, who's come to the camp from Toronto and who has to like at least some of what her coach has to say.
It's all there. She's just got to get it all on point, going at the same time. And once she gets that, I mean, she'll be hitting way farther than she's been. And she's already knocking the crap out of the ball. She's still a little off with her swing. And as long as she, you know, gets the key points down, she's going to be phenomenal at bat.
Michaela Seiler knows whereof she speaks. She's been playing baseball since early childhood. By the time she was 12, she was playing it well enough to join a girls' team that traveled to Australia for a series of games under the auspices of an organization called Baseball for All, the same organization running the camp where Michaela is coaching. Like most of the girls at the camp, she learned the game on a boys' team, and it was a challenge.
You're the only girl on a whole team of boys, and you got to work 10 times harder, and you have to be on your best behavior, because all they want to do is to push you down, because you're going against what people normally know, and they don't like that. So a lot of the times you just it's hard to keep fighting when everyone else is telling you to stop fighting.
Many of the ballplayers at this camp are the only girls on their teams back home, but some of them are less challenged in that circumstance than Michaela Seiler has been. Trinity Gonzalez flew to Massachusetts with her mom from 29 Palms, California, where Trinity, who is 11, is the only girl on her travel team. She's a catcher, and she's good enough so that each time the team's best pitcher starts, he wants Trinity behind the plate.
Well, we're best friends, and we've been playing together since I was 5 and he was 6 years old. And we started a travel ball team, so we play year-round together. And I was just the catcher the whole time.
And, boy, with all that catcher's equipment on, you must nearly disappear. You're not very big. How tall are you?
I'm 4'8".
4'8". How'd you pick catcher?
Well, I tried all the positions when I was little, and I didn't like any of them. So the only one I didn't try was catcher, and I really liked it because you get to see what's going on and stuff.
As Trinity stepped in for her turn in the batting cage, I spoke with her mother, Leslie, who's 100% behind her daughter's determination to stay with baseball rather than shift to softball, as girls are so often pressured to do.
You know, they want it just as bad as the boys, so I feel if they have the skill and can get it done, what's the difference?
Leslie Gonzalez has another daughter who plays on her high school softball team and a son who was drafted by the Marlins, an advantage, I'd think, for an 11-year-old catcher, no matter that catcher's gender.
He works with her a lot, and her dad works with her a lot. He coaches her travel ball team and stuff, so we'll see.
That's great.
Let them take it as far as they can.
Besides instruction in hitting, fielding, base running, and the various other skills associated with the game, campers learn something about baseball's sometimes arcane rules. On the afternoon of my visit, there was a seminar on the balk.
Now, if the pitcher gets the ball, they might still want to trick the runner, right? Okay? Say the pitcher has the ball.
Eventually, a veteran umpire named Perry Barber figured that maybe it was time for a seventh-inning stretch in this seminar. She hauled out her guitar, and suddenly the summer baseball camp began to sound a lot like, well, just summer camp. Let me root for the home. The following day, the campers got on a bus and headed for Boston, where they'd get a late afternoon tour of Fenway Park. But first, there was baseball to be played. The girls associated with Baseball for All spread out over two diamonds to play with and against a group of boys attending a baseball camp at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Among the most interested observers was Justine Siegel, who founded Baseball for All a decade ago. She said she'd been asking the campers to tell her about what they liked best in the program.
They say two things. One is the friends they're making, and the second is they like playing against the boys.
On the first play of the game I was watching, one of the boys cracked a sharp grounder to third, where one of the Baseball for All campers fielded the ball and fired it to first, beating the runner by several steps. I asked Justine Siegel whether male hitters put out by girls or male pitchers who gave up hits to female batters were still likely to hear about it from their teammates.
Yeah, I think it's still set up in the culture, but most of that is adult-driven, and the kids, you gain their respect pretty quickly. So once the adults sort of keep their own fears out, the kids just respect each other's ball players and want to go have fun.
And maybe she's right. As I watched that game on Wednesday afternoon, I found that I was paying less attention to the genders of the players and more attention to how well they were playing, which, according to Justine Siegel, is a big part of what Baseball for All is about.
You know, that's my goal. My goal is that this is no longer a news story, and girls and boys are playing baseball. It's our national pastime, and to me, it's the greatest game on earth.
The campers at Baseball for All no doubt agree, and many of them will return from camp to the teams on which they are the only girls, secure in the conviction that lots of other Michaelas and Justines, Trinities and Jackies share that opinion. According to Urban Dictionary, the term next man can be used in derogatory fashion. The so-called next man is just another guy. But if you visit Ottawa, you might learn about a next man who was a lot more than just another guy. Stroll down Elgin Street and stop at the public park honoring Canadian sports hero Jack Purcell. The park features racket-shaped light poles, which are fitting tributes to the late badminton champion and tennis shoe designer, which is fine, except that he's not the guy for whom the tribute was meant. The park was intended to honor a local hero by the same name, whose public claim to fame was his willingness to repair sticks and sharpen skates for Ottawa's young hockey players. In May of 2015, I called upon Matthew Pearson of the Ottawa Citizen to explain this Purcellian mix-up. I wondered how it was even possible that the architects who designed the park and the city officials who commissioned it missed the fact that they were honoring the wrong Jack Purcell.
Bill, I think that's a question that many folks in Ottawa are asking themselves. Essentially, it comes down to the fact that when you enter the name Jack Purcell into Google, the first hit that you come up with, of course, is the community center and park. But further down, you come up with hits for Jack Purcell, the badminton player. Mm-hmm. In one of those hits even suggested that the community center in Ottawa was, in fact, named for Jack Purcell, the badminton player. But if you were around Ottawa in the 50s or 60s, you would remember that there was a very different Jack Purcell in the neighborhood. And I think that he's maybe been forgotten a bit because he lived and died before the internet.
Well, tell me a little bit about Jack Purcell, the hockey stick mender, and why folks in Ottawa felt that a $500,000 tribute to him was a good idea.
Jack Purcell was a man who lived off Elgin Street. Kids could come to the house and he would fix their hockey sticks, and then he later went on to even sharpen skates. So he was known in the community as the stick doctor. In the 60s, when they were getting closer to having this community center, there was a real movement in the community that this park and this community center needed to be named for Jack Purcell.
At what point did the park's designers realize that an error had been made, and what happened when they came to that realization?
What I understand is that they submitted their plans for the park, and a local historian said, hey, wait a sec, this park is named after a different Jack Purcell. And went to the city archives and sure enough found that there is in fact this local Jack Purcell who had nothing to do with badminton. And so they told that to the designer. We haven't seen the original drawings for the park, but they look like rackets. Some people think they look like question marks or keys. And the city councilor, Diane Holmes, said that according to her, the initial plan was to actually string the rackets so they would maybe even look more like rackets.
You interviewed Carrie Purcell Grant, who's the great-granddaughter of the badminton champion. What did she have to say about the mix-up?
Well, it's kind of funny. Carrie moved to Ottawa from Toronto about 10 years ago, and while she was studying, she figured that it must be named for her great-grandfather. And so she called her mom, and she said, why didn't you ever tell me this? And her mom said, I don't think that it's named after your great-grandfather. And so they went to Google and found out that, according to this one website, it was. So they actually visited the community center, and a funny thing happened because the staff at the community center said the park is named for the local guy, and they showed them a picture of him, and he definitely wasn't Cary Grant's great-grandfather, but then the community center staff said he also was a famous badminton player. So it seemed like even they were a bit confused and were sort of conflating the two men. And what I think is kind of a funny little coincidence is that she didn't play badminton, but she played hockey.
Of course.
So the Jack Purcell hockey stick mender would have been a good friend of hers.
Matthew Pearson is the Ottawa Citizen City Hall reporter. You can link to his series of articles about Jack Purcell Park at onlyagame.org. Matthew, this has been great fun. Thank you for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure, Bill.
I'm just trying to be the best teammate I can be. It seems that every time we open the sports page or click on SI.com, there's another story of athletes who are not particularly good teammates. Stories about NCAA athletes doing good things seem to get less press. In 2013, Only a Game's Karen Given found an organization whose mission is to provide hundreds of teammates for children who desperately need good ones on their side.
A few dozen people have gathered in North Andover, Massachusetts to welcome the latest men's soccer recruit to Merrimack College. Emerging from the dressing room wearing his new team uniform for the first time, Brady Antea strides to the stage and climbs behind a long table. As his feet swing below him, Brady pushes his thick glasses up and rests his chin in his hands. Merrimack head coach Tony Martone doesn't make a habit of holding flashy signing ceremonies for his players.
No, only special young men like Brady. My players get welcome to the locker room and into the field, basically. And before they get any accolades, they do a lot of hard work.
Brady is 6. He's legally deaf and blind due to CHARGE syndrome, a genetic condition diagnosed the day after his birth. His soccer skills could charitably be described as still developing. But as a recruit from Team Impact, an organization that pairs college sports teams and kids with life-threatening and chronic illnesses, Coach Martone seems confident that Brady will be an important contributor to Merrimack soccer.
Wearing number 1, Brady Antea.
Martone signed on for Team Impact as a way for his team to give back to the community. Ask his players, like Francis Mulkern and Andrew Suttle, and they'll say it's worked the other way around.
Preseason is no fun, really. But anytime he shows up, it brightens all of our days up. And
having Brady around, your work ethic goes up, and seeing him, he puts a smile on your face. You have a bad practice, see this kid, and it kind of puts everything in perspective. And, you know, see him smile, it changes everything, and it's amazing.
Brady and the Merrimack soccer team are still getting to know each other. But this June, 30 miles north of Chicago, a more established Team Impact pairing was playing basketball on the concrete floor of the empty ice rink at Lake Forest College.
I am Griffin.
Griffin, how old are you?
7.
Griffin Max was diagnosed with leukemia at 2.5. By the time his mom, Gretchen, found Team Impact, he had undergone 3.5 years of chemo and was in remission.
You know, we wanted positive vibes. We wanted Griffin to know that he's a survivor, he can do this. You know, especially with a sport like hockey, you know, it's kind of grueling. But when you win, it's such a great feeling.
None of the Macs were hockey fans when Griffin was drafted by Lake Forest. And as it turns out, Griffin isn't the only member of the family the team decided to take on.
My name is Kylie, and I'm 7.
Griffin, Hudson, and their sister Kylie are triplets. Along with their older brother Everest, the 4 Macs kids keep the Lake Forest team pretty busy. But head coach Ryan McKelvey isn't concerned about getting more than he signed up for.
Oh, man, I wish we could have one Griffin for every kid on our team.
At first, Coach McKelvey was more worried about what the Macs had taken on.
It seemed like for a while, I think they came for a lot of losses. and it was like after a game, it was like we'd be so frustrated with the loss and we'd be going in to talk to the players and we'd see, you know, Griffin and his family standing out there. And it was like, well, that's really what it's about. And we might have lost a game, but it's just a game. And all the kids would come in and give everybody a high five. And you know, I think it made things a lot easier or better.
But the Macs brought more than a dedicated cheering section to the experience of players like senior forward Mike Violette.
It almost like makes me feel like grounded. Like it just brings a smile to my face just to come down here and just release everything, release all my stress and just kind of just forget about everything. Sit back and pretend I'm a kid again.
Gretchen Max says the Lake Forest players are giving Griffin back some of the childhood he lost, and the Max kids are learning to be siblings again. Griffin might be done with chemo, but he still has bad days. They never happen on Tuesday, the day he skates with Lake Forest.
When he comes here, he's all smiles. It's like, it's not, you know, the crabby Griffin is gone. You know, he sees all the guys and he's happy.
I'll talk to her mom. They're completely good to go. I do have an update on her health and everything like that, so.
Matching up kids in schools doesn't happen by magic. Every morning, Maura Mahoney, director of case management and communications for Team Impact, takes the staff through the list of kids looking to be paired up with teams.
As you can imagine, there's a lot that goes into each match. I can't even think of the average number of phone calls. I mean, the number of phone calls that we make on average as a case management team every day is a lot.
Each potential match is carefully debated and planned. Geography is important, as is making sure both the family and the team are committed to the match. The easiest part of the process seems to be finding college teams that want to be involved.
We have probably close to 1,500 teams that are looking for a kid, are banging down our door looking for their newest recruit, so to speak.
Pairing sick kids with college sports teams isn't a new idea. Organizations like Make-A-Wish have long been arranging one-day connections, and kids with brain cancer can be paired with schools through the Friends of Jaclyn. Team Impact wanted to expand the idea, creating lasting connections between college sports teams and kids facing all sorts of medical challenges. First, individual teams signed up, then entire schools, and finally, full college conferences got involved. Now, Executive Director Dan Walsh says Team Impact is facing a new, unexpected problem.
There's enough stories and news articles and videos that, you know, it's pretty quick to illustrate to the athletic community kind of what the experience is all about, and they're quick to sign up. Our biggest challenge and daily focus is just trying to find more children, more families that could benefit from this.
Walsh can't promise a kid will be paired with his or her favorite team or even their favorite sport, but he says it's not about picking favorites. It's about having 20, 30, even 100 older brothers and sisters during good times and bad. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
If you lose, you go home. Sure, it's a cliche, but sometimes it's simply not true. Sometimes you go home to take a stand against prejudice and intolerance, even when you're good enough to be a champion. In 1934, the American Legion All-Star Baseball Team in Springfield, Massachusetts, won the New England Championship, thereby earning the right to compete in the Eastern Regionals in Gastonia, North Carolina. But for the presence on the Springfield team of Bunny Taliaferro, that might not have led to much of a story. In early 2014, I spoke with Richard Anderson, the author of a children's book titled A Home Run for Bunny, and with illustrator Gerald Purnell. I asked Anderson to tell me how he learned about Bunny Taliaferro and the team for which he played.
A former student of mine from the Springfield College School of Human Services was riding her bicycle through Forest Park in Springfield. It was a hot day, and she sat down on a bench to rest. And when she looked up, she was looking at a stone monument, and she read the words on the monument. And as she was reading, she thought, I know someone who would like this story. She called me on her cell phone. She read the words on the monument word for word. And as she was reading the story of the 1934 Post-21 team, I imagined the whole thing as a children's story.
Gerald, the book is beautifully illustrated. What drew you to the story, no pun intended, as an illustrator?
As soon as I heard the story, I was delighted to be asked to be involved in it. I thought it was a good opportunity to show kids the diversity that existed. This is 75 years ago. Mm-hmm. And to have a group of kids playing together and sticking together as a team was pretty significant. So I sort of jumped at the opportunity to illustrate it.
Richard, I'm going to read just a couple of sentences from the book. We knew something was wrong just after the train pulled into Gastonia. The band that had been playing walked off as soon as they saw Bunny step onto the platform. And then the bus pulled away, leaving us stranded, and we had to carry our bags and equipment all the way to the hotel. Tell us a little bit about what happened next when the team got to their hotel.
They were told that their rooms were ready and they could check into them, but not Bunny Taliaferro, not the one black player on the team. The hotel had made arrangements, as it had done in the past, for Bunny to stay with what was referred to then as a local Negro doctor's family. The coach of the team, Coach Babe Steer, refused to allow this to happen. He said that Bunny was a member of the team, and where the team went, that's where Bunny went. A discussion followed, and finally, it was resolved that Bunny could stay at the hotel, but he had to be listed as Coach Steer's valet. He had to sleep on a cot. He couldn't sleep in a bed reserved for white people. And no one in the hotel could mistake him for one of the ball players. He had to look and act like the coach's valet.
Despite the prejudice, the team goes out onto the ball field to practice, and Bunny is the first member of the Springfield team to pick up a bat. I'm going to read a little bit more from the page that describes that. Bunny was the first to make a move. He grabbed his bat, stepped up to the plate, and started taking cuts at imaginary pitches. When Coach Steer told us to take our positions on the field for once, I was glad to be warming the bench. More threats and jeers filled the air as Coach made his way to the mound. "Batter up," he called. Bunny lined the first pitch over the left field fence. That silenced the crowd, but only for a second. Coach Steer threw his second pitch, and Bunny airmailed that one out of the park, too. Special delivery to the people of Gastonia. The more noise the crowd made, the smoother Bunny swung. He hit 6 home runs on 6 pitches. And that's when it started raining soda bottles, tin cans, and half-eaten hot dogs.
Yes, this was an extraordinary feat. And if you remember, up to this point, Bunny has no voice in what's happening to him. The band leaves the platform, the bus pulls away, he can't stay at the hotel. He feels guilty, he feels ashamed, he feels responsible for what's happening to the other members of the team. 2,000 people showed up at this practice to jeer the players, to threaten them with things that were beyond their imagination. And then Bunny came up to the plate. He hit 6 home runs on 6 pitches, and not just home runs. He hit the ball out of the park. It's absolutely, to me and to Gerald, I know, extraordinary feat.
Oh, I love that. That was a very significant moment in the book.
Gerald, there is an especially striking illustration just before that point in the book. It's a close-up of what I assume is Bunny's eye. Could you describe that image for us?
Well, it talks about when the afternoon when they first got to the practice and there were 2,000 people showed up and they were jeering and they were screaming at Bunny and the team. When I thought about illustrating that, I didn't want to illustrate it in a way. This is a children's picture book, so I wanted to do it in a way that was respectful and in a way that would not be too hard for kids to understand what was going on. So I thought and eventually did do a very close-up of Bunny's eye and the reflection in the highlight of the eye. You can see the crowd. You can see some faces in the crowd yelling and just one little teardrop coming out of Bunny's eye. And I thought that might be just kind of significant way of portraying what he might have been going through, what he might have been feeling at that time.
Eventually, the teams from Maryland and Florida announce that they will not play in the tournament if Bunny participates, and the members of the Springfield team are faced with a decision. Richard, tell us about what that decision was and how they handled it.
The coach gave them a choice. There were two things they could do. They could play without Bunny. And the coach told them that he thought they were good enough to win without Bunny. And if they did win the tournament, they would go on to the national championships in Chicago. Or they could pack their bags and go home. The first person to speak was Captain Tony King, who at 95 years old is the sole surviving member of the team. And what Tony said on that night of August 23rd, 1934, he said, "Bunny is a member of the team. If he doesn't play, I'm not playing either." And every member of the team followed suit. They voted unanimously and without debate to go back to Springfield.
Richard Anderson is the author of A Home Run for Bunny, which features illustrations by Gerald Purnell. It's published by Illumination Arts. Richard, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill.
And Gerald Purnell, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Bill. It was a pleasure being here. It was a pleasure talking to you.
A few months after my interview with Anderson and Purnell, listener John Alexander wrote Gastonia's mayor, John Bridgman. He suggested that after all these years, perhaps the mayor of Gastonia should write the mayor of Springfield in order to apologize for the shameful treatment of the Springfield team, which he did. It was, the mayor said, a learning moment and a fitting final chapter to the story of Bunny Taliaferro. One sports cliché to make it far beyond the world of sports is the ball's in your court. But when it comes to one sport popular in the British Commonwealth, the cliché can perhaps be modified to the bowl is on your lawn. Only a Game's Doug Tribou attended the 2014 Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, Scotland, which attracted more than 4,500 athletes from 71 nations and territories that once comprised the British Empire. The games featured many fast events, including the men's 4x100-meter relay, in which Usain Bolt and his Jamaican teammates won gold. But fans also turned out for a sport that is decidedly slow. Then again, when a game has been played for centuries, it can afford to take its time.
There are three things I need to clear up right away about the sport of lawn bowls. First, lawn bowls does not involve pins. Second, lawn bowls is not bocce. Plenty of similarities, understandable mistake, but not the same game. And third, the word lawn is a misnomer, unless your idea of a lawn is a pristine rectangle of grass that could double as a massive putting green at a swanky golf course. The game wasn't invented in Scotland, but Scots came up with many of the rules still in place today. And bowlsclub.org lists 120 clubs in the city of Glasgow alone. So it's just the spot for one of the world's top bowls competitions. I'm standing outside Kelvin Grove Park, the site of the Lawn Bowl Center for the Commonwealth Games here in Glasgow, and the weather has turned decidedly more Glaswegian. The skies are gray, some rain is falling, and that's after 3 or 4 days of 80 degrees, sunshine, and humidity. And it seems appropriate for this sport that's so popular here in Scotland. The grass is lush and green, the courts are perfectly manicured, and despite the weather, hundreds of fans have turned out in ponchos and raincoats and carrying umbrellas to watch the games.
My name's Kate Smith, I live in Norfolk Island, and I'm the team manager.
26 squads have come to Glasgow, including Kate Smith and her teammates from Norfolk Island, which is in the South Pacific and has a population of about 2,000. The Commonwealth Games are held every 4 years, and Lawn Bowls has appeared on nearly every program since the first games in 1930. There are men's and women's events in singles, pairs, triples, and fours. Between matches, Smith describes the basic goal of bowls.
There's a small white ball at one end of the green, which is 30-something meters away. And the object of the game is to get your bigger bowls closest to that little white ball at the end.
That small white ball, which can also be yellow, is known as the jack. Greg Davis is a bowler for Jersey, a semi-autonomous island in the English Channel.
Effectively, you've got to get more bowls closer to that jack by the end of the end than your opposition. Obviously, the more bowls you've got closer to the jack by the time all the bowls have been bowled, the more points you score.
Here in the shadow of Glasgow's famous Kelvin Grove Museum, the greens are divided into several lanes known as rinks. There are small ditches at each end. If the bowler sends the ball into the ditch without hitting the jack, it's taken out of play. After all the balls are rolled, competitors walk down the rink together and play the next set, or end, in the opposite direction. Although the lanes are flat, a roll is not a straight shot because the balls aren't perfect spheres, which makes them curve. Team Jersey bowler Chris Grimes.
They all come in various sizes. You choose it to suit your hand, and it's got a bias on it, so you have to choose which side you're going to bowl your bowl. If you do it the wrong way, you're going to get a wrong bias. It's going to shoot right over the other side of the green.
One quick point of clarification. In bowls, the balls are also called bowls. Some hardcore bowlers may be bowled over when they hear the terms used interchangeably, but I hope they won't bawl me out because of it. Anyway, bowls is all about strategy, placing shots to knock an opponent's bowls out of position or bump a teammate's closer to the jack. Bowlers often play almost silently, but like any good sport, the athletes occasionally end up yelling at the ball.
Come home now! Come home now!
Fighting to come round.
That's a very good shot. Looks like a three.
BBC play-by-play, or roll-by-roll, is a modern addition to this ancient game. According to lore, English sailor and explorer Sir Francis Drake insisted on finishing a game before sailing off to battle the Spanish Armada in 1588, and Shakespeare referenced it in some of his plays, including King Richard II.
What sport shall we devise here in this garden to drive away the heavy thought of care?
Madam, we'll play at bowls.
But the game was hardly new when the bard penned his shout-outs. The world's oldest active bowls club is the Southampton Old Bowling Green in England. It opened in the year 1299. Today, this game for the ages is also a game for all ages. Young and old play side by side. Team Jersey's Chris Grimes started bowling when she was about 40. Today, she's 63 years old.
I took it up as a hobby and found out I was quite good at it and then got selected in competition. And so the bowls don't know your age.
Grimes' teammate Greg Davis is only 25. A computer business consultant by day, Davis discovered the game at the age of 12.
There's more young people getting involved now than I think for a long time, especially back home. So the future's bright from that perspective. But we do need to keep raising the profile of the game and making it more attractive for the younger bowlers so we get fresh blood in, and that can only be good for the sport.
The game's international governing body, World Bowls, reports 51 member nations, including the U.S. There's an annual Bowls World Cup, got to be a soup joke in there somewhere, and the World Championships are held every 4 years. At the Commonwealth Games, South Africa topped the medal count, with Scotland, England, New Zealand, and Malaysia rounding out the top five. But Julie Brunt, who manages a large bowls center in Australia and traveled to Glasgow to root for some friends, says in bowls, camaraderie beats competition every time.
It's like one big happy family. We all get along very well. It's a very sociable game.
And that's the main reason why the game of bowls rolls on. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
It was good times on the job on the day we came up with a theme for this show. That was at least in part because we'd all been temporarily released from the injunction to avoid clichés like the plague, or something. Anyway, it was liberating when somebody hit on the idea that after 22 years of avoiding clichés, it was time to embrace them. We would build a show around the most stale, hollow, dead expressions we could recall, recognizing that because practice might make perfect, we would not practice this because we didn't want to get good at it, let alone perfect, since, after all, winning isn't everything. What? Anyway, it was heartening to realize that avoiding sports clichés for all those years had not dulled our collective ability to recall dumb language and wallow in it, unless it wasn't heartening. Actually, dumb language is smart language. If you're a player trying to avoid making news, recall, if you will, the advice minor league veteran Crash Davis gives his rookie teammate, Nuke LaLoosh, about what he should say to the press in the movie classic Bull Durham.
We got to play him one day at a time.
Got to play. It's pretty boring.
Of course it's boring. That's the point. Write it down.
One day.
All right, I'm just happy to be here. Hope I can help the ball club. I know, write it down.
Crash Davis is right. You'll never get in trouble providing your audience with clichés, unless you're trying to create a sports radio program for listeners with opposable thumbs, as Charlie Pierce once put it. So this week we've gotten You Lose and You Go Home and the Ball's in Your Court out of the way forever, I hope. And next week, we promise we'll give 110% or maybe even 120% or maybe not, because anything over 100% and you're not staying within yourself, which is important, especially when time is running out, which it is. Thank goodness. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from 100-time loser Zippy Chippy. That's a Triple Crown Winnie if I ever heard one, and not a cliche, and it came right after I gave Zippy an apple. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.